Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
We all know our brains react to music because we can feel ourselves react to music. But how does that happen? Are human brains hardwired for sound? And what about these musicians? What's happening in their brains? After all, they're elephants. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today we look at the biology of music, both our own and that of the Thai Elephant Orchestra. Later in the show, composer David Soldier, who's also a neuroscientist, we'll share the amazing story of the group of elephant musicians you're hearing in the background. But first, let's stick with our own species. Our ongoing series called Ear Wars has examined how we hear music, how our ears respond to sound, how it can be both excited and even damaged by sound. And one thing we've learned is that real listening doesn't happen in the ear. It happens in the brain. That's why we've invited back to the show another neuroscientist who's also a musician. Daniel Levitin is author of the best-selling book, This Is Your Brain on Music. Dan, welcome back.
Nice to be here.
So you've been doing this series of talks called Music and the Brain, and the final one is on the biology of our emotional responses to music.
Yeah.
Is our brain different when we're listening to music?
Well, it's kind of a trick question because our brain is different when we do anything. We activate different modes of thought and neural activation, whether we're eating or drinking or listening to music or listening to a speech or sleeping. All these different things we do activate different neural pathways, and even some of the same neurons can be put into a different mode, whether you're listening to a poem or just plain speech or music.
Mm-hmm. Does it matter if you're actively listening to music or if it's on in the background? Is your brain responding differently?
For most people, yes. If you're listening with focused attention and you're riding the wave of every note into what's inevitably coming up to the with the next notes, that's a different kind of processing, and your neural circuits are being activated in a different way. You're trying to predict what's going to happen next. And your brain is sometimes getting rewarded and sometimes not, depending on what the composer decides to do.
So that's why your brain is getting that reward mechanism is being activated more with music you know, because you do know what's coming next.
Or new music that sounds like something you know, right? A lot of the reason that people liked the Beatles was that the Beatles, in their early days at least, were trying to imitate Buddy Holly and Chuck Berry and Elvis. So there was a sense of familiarity, although it was novel at the same time.
So you got both that frisson of excitement of the new and the comfort of the old.
Yeah, I like the way you put that, and I think this is something David can speak to as well. But
you mean Dave Soldier later?
Yeah. neurons as a collective, when they're all put together into a circuit, they have this dual preference. They want what's new because they like novelty, but they also want the familiar. They want to be put into familiar patterns. That's what memory is.
Mm.
Memory is a bunch of neurons settling into a familiar pattern and recalling a state they were in before. So music is such a special stimulus because it's riding the balance of those two things, the novel and the familiar.
Daniel Levitin's talk tonight at the 92nd Street Y is called Music and the Mind, From Neurons to Nirvana. Speaking of which, here's Nirvana.
I'm so happy, 'cause today found my friends in my head. I'm so ugly, that's okay, 'cause so are you. Book on me is Sunday morning, is every day for all I care. And I'm not scared. Light my candles in our days, 'cause I found God.
All right, so the talk is Music in the Mind, From Neurons to Nirvana. That's Nirvana. And Dan, right now, some of our listeners are going, yeah, Nirvana. And other listeners are going, ugh, Nirvana. Are they having...
Some were probably about to change the station.
Are they having different chemical reactions? Is the biology of our emotion different according to the emotion?
I would say so, yes. But, if you look at the broad domain of human experience, that's not so surprising, right? You might like spicy Thai food. Somebody else might want to have bland white bread, peanut butter for lunch, right? I mean, our aesthetic experiences are quite idiosyncratic and different, and they relate to different patterns of neural activation. Some listeners are going to be going, their fear center in the amygdala is going to say, this is very unfamiliar to me, I'm uncomfortable.
And other people?
Other people are going to have that squirt of dopamine that says, this is just great.
All right. Now, your guest tonight at this talk at the 92nd Street Y is Adam Gopnik, the author and staff writer for The New Yorker. You've said, Dan, that he is one of the best at translating what you cognitive scientists do into everyday language. Adam, first of all, welcome to Soundcheck. And secondly, what is Dan talking about?
Well, pleasure to be here. I think Dan means no more than married to the mob. My sister is a well-known cognitive scientist. My mother is a very well-known cognitive scientist. So I grew up hearing the stuff, tried to escape it by going off to become a writer, but couldn't entirely succeed. You know, it's fascinating to me listening to the Nirvana and hearing what Dan has to say about it, because it brings to mind a sort of more general problem, which I think affects directly the meanings and the uses of cognitive science when it comes to questions of taste. And that is, at what level of organization does taste go on? I just gave a long talk about literal taste in your mouth, and how your mouth taste changes your moral taste. And one of the things that's true about human beings, Dan knows far more about this than I do, is that we like to play perverse little games with our taste. So, for instance, we love, just as Dan was saying, spicy food. Now, we love it in part because eating super spicy food forces our brains to produce opiates that make us feel good. If we didn't get the opiates, the food would be intolerable. And there are all of those kinds of perverse effects. Thinking about Nirvana, one of my favorite lines that explains the history of taste is in Al Yankovic's great parody of Smells Like Teen Spirit, you remember, where he says, we're so loud and incoherent, boy, this ought to bug your parents. And
right.
There's an awful lot of musical taste is created on the boy, this ought to bug your parents basis. So does it feel good? No, it's not meant to feel good. It's meant to be maximum annoying to people who are unfamiliar with it. And so
it's like a secret code.
Yeah.
That's what the Beatles were for one generation, or what Nirvana was for another, or what, to some extent, Lady Gaga is to this generation.
That's right.
Members of this generation. It's a code.
Punk rocks.
Right.
But are you suggesting that people like these different acts because of the annoyance factor? Or, I mean, there's got to be something for them
not
in and of itself.
Not because of it, but that's certainly a part and parcel of the deal, right? It's that also...
Well, one of the things, not to interrupt again, but one of the things I think is generally true about taste, don't you agree, is that we love to dance on the edge of revulsion. In other words, when thinking about, what are the most prized things we eat? Truffles, which almost smell like garbage, right? Caviar, which is almost beyond the edge of salt. And in the same way, my son, my 16-year-old, loves the Strokes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he loves the Strokes in part because the Strokes are just at the edge of my understanding, but he hears them as this incredibly melodic, emotional thing. So he's walking on the edge between violation of the norm and satisfaction of the norm. And I think that's where a lot of aesthetic experience takes place.
And they group speak to his generation exclusively, which allows him and his generation to develop a sense of otherness from their parents, which is what adolescence is about.
And one of the things that art gives us is as identity.
We're speaking with Daniel Levitin, the neuroscientist, author of This Is Your Brain on Music and The World in Six Songs, and Adam Gopnik, the author, essayist, staff writer for The New Yorker. And actually, Adam, you are working on a musical now.
It's been the greatest adventure of my creative life, as I've been working with the great composer David Shire, who's won Oscars and written great Broadway shows and lots of movie scores, on an adaptation of a book of mine. And it's been a boot camp for somebody. I think everybody is an amateur songwriter. Everybody has two businesses, their own in the movie business, and everybody has their own job, and then they write songs on the side. And I am one of those amateur songwriters.
Well, if I could interject here, one of the things we know is that young children, when they're just learning language, year and a half to two and a half, they're babbling, boo-boo, goo-goo, ga-ga, playing with the sounds of language. We now know that all young children go through a period where they invent songs. They're not just playing with syllables, but with melody and rhythm. And around the pre-linguistic phase of development, they'll be going, they're making up songs. And that is...
I like it.
You can use it.
All right.
But that's quelled, right? I mean, the language takes over. They're told not to do that. Or, you know, and others of them are supported in it.
So is there something to be sort of gleaned from the babblings of kids in terms of keeping kind of a musical sense alive as you get older?
I think that certainly the kids are – one of the glories of parenting is that your kids keep you in touch with popular music, certainly, and with music more broadly because they care so passionately about it. And, you know, it's the thing – the music we hear as teenagers gets beyond our hearts into our bones. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, now, it happens to be the case that all the greatest music ever composed was composed between 1969 and 1973 when I was in high school. That happens to be a fact.
An indisputable fact, yeah.
I wonder if you had it's a coincidence that I happened to be in high school in those years.
If you had a bone marrow transplant, would you have new music in there?
I think so, don't you think? It's whatever you hear then.
Well, Dan, you suggested a couple of pieces of music for us to listen to as we continue this conversation of the biology of music. How our brain produces its emotional responses. And kind of one of the pieces you chose was Claire and the Reasons and their song Pluto. And it strikes me in the context of what you guys were just saying that she has a very kind of childlike means of delivery here.
Yes.
Is that what you were looking at?
What I love about this band and their writing is that there's a childlike innocence and sense of wide-eyed wonder at the world. And it comes across musically and lyrically.
This song's called Pluto. Claire and the Reasons in a song called Pluto.
Brooklyn Band.
Daniel Levitin with me in the studio, the neuroscientist, author of This Is Your Brain on Music, along with Adam Gopnik of The New Yorker, who's writing a musical at the moment. And the two of them are doing this talk tonight at the 92nd Street Y at 8 p.m. called Music and the Mind, From Neurons to Nirvana. And we're looking at kind of the brain's emotional responses to music. Dan, here's a comment from listener Dee Dee, who writes, "Your guest just described what makes dance music and techno so listenable and enjoyable for 10 hours at a time. Novelty couched deeply in the familiar. 32 beats and change." That I guess you could say that about any form of kind of repetitive, I mean, the trance traditions
yes.
of the world, things
yes.
like that?
Well, and the kind of trance music you're talking about from shamans or indigenous peoples where for hours and hours there would be dancing or meditating, the music would change in subtle ways against a background of repetition. And the repetition may actually be involved in creating or nurturing the trance state through the synchronous firing of neurons. Neurons will fire in synchrony to a beat. And when that happens, it's possible that your brainwave state can change and you can be lulled into an alternate state of consciousness.
And it doesn't have to be a shaman on the steps of Central Asia. It could be Daft Punk in the clubs.
That's
you
right.
get that entrainment, as they call it, happening, and things do happen. the band Daft Punk. That's a different sort of trance music. And we're talking about music and the mind, neurons and nirvana. It's the subject of Dan Levitin and Adam Gopnik's talk tonight at the 92nd Street Y and the latest installment in our Ear Wars series on Soundcheck, where we look at human hearing. And Adam, is there a difference between writing an essay or fiction, both of which you've done, and writing music, writing for musical theater?
Well, writing a lyric, writing words for musical theater is, of course, an art form of incredible deft precision when you do it well. I wouldn't claim that when a Stephen Sondheim or a Lorenz Hart does it. I think that they have something in common, though, which is essentially their exercises in storytelling. Even a very abstract essay. I have one about the internet in the magazine this week. You only can really write it if you have a beginning and an end. You have a metaphor that it's going to move. The metaphor is toasters in this week's one. Wizards and toasters. You have to have that. You have to know what the beginning is and what the end is. Otherwise, it becomes a term paper. That's how we tell the difference between a term paper and an essay. And similarly, one of the things you learn when you're trying to write songs is that songs are stories. We're not always conscious of that when we're as listeners because they have elements of familiarity and repetition. But any good song begins in emotional space A and ends in emotional space B. Think of My Funny Valentine, right? Mm-hmm. Which starts off in the minor and it's brooding and it works its way around to the major in the sunshine of affirmation. That's a perfect song. And any good song needs to have that kind of trajectory. But the big question for me is somebody writing, learning to write lyrics, writing them my whole life and for myself and other and friends, is the magic of music. That is, it's an abstract arrangement of sounds, and yet it's the most emotionally powerful thing that we have in our lives. How does that happen, Dan? Why is it that we hear...
Before you answer, let me throw that question out to our listeners. I mean, have you ever had that experience of a particularly strong and even surprising emotional reaction to a piece of music? You can let us know on the phones, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or leave a comment, and there are some pretty interesting ones already on the webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. The number again, 212-433-WNYC. A particularly surprising, a really powerful, strong emotional response to a piece of music. If that's happened to you, let us know with a call or a comment on the webpage. So, Dan, how does that happen?
Well, I mean, in the case of Adam is just a master at writing, at the written word. And, I get serious writer's envy when I read anything that Adam has written. And I think, how could anybody have thought of such a perfect way to explain this, along with there being a story there? And I think we get that from music. We get the sense that there's a story that if a piece of music works, you're going to feel differently at the end of each line than you felt at the beginning of that line. Otherwise, the line has no reason to be there. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about lyrical songs.
Well, now, another piece of music you suggested we might profit from listening to is Rodney Crowell and his piece called The Rock of My Soul. This is not just a story, it's his story.
Yes, and it's featured in his new biography just out, his memoir, China Berry Sidewalks.
And he's actually coming up on Fresh Air at the conclusion of this show. So here's a little bit from Rodney Crowell.
That's what I remember about the rock of my soul. I told him I would kill him if he did not stop it. Oh, but the rock of my soul just would not drop it. I learned to lie like dirt. I could steal your shirt and talk with a gun. Another Houston kid on a downhill skid, like father, like son.
That is Rodney Crowell and a story, his own story, in the song The Rock of My Soul. And this raises a question. Adam was talking, Dan, a moment ago about, music is just like this abstract arrangement of notes. But once you put words on it, it's no longer abstract. So what is triggering that emotional response? Is it words that we can understand, or is it the music?
Well, let me give you two answers. So on an aesthetic level, of course, the words are being supported by or supporting a melody. And sometimes they're consonant with one another. You can have a beautiful set of lyric images with beautiful music. Or sometimes they're in opposition to one another when the writer is trying to be ironic or sarcastic or be indirect. You can have a very beautiful image with threatening music, which makes you feel very differently. If you say, I'm feeling fine, I'm feeling okay, and the music is going, right? You know that the person is very much not okay. At a neural level, what's going on, of course, is that the brain is trying to integrate all this information from disparate areas of the brain, from the front and the back, the center, the outside, the left and the right hemispheres, and it all comes together somewhere. We don't know where yet, although Christoph Koch has a new book out coming soon on consciousness that may answer the question of where it's coming together, the particular region. But the brain's trying to build up some model of reality as conveyed through this artwork. There's a particular part of the brain that's often invoked in songs like the one we heard that's involved in self-consciousness that injects you into any story. And we've seen in neuroimaging experiments that's often activated during music listening. The eye center,
so even
we call
that's, it. Even though that's his story, some part of my brain is identifying it as somehow my story.
Or what parts of that might be true of me. Yeah, where we came in on the story, he was just talking about how his father used to beat his mother, and he threatened to shoot his father.
Right.
We may not all have been in that situation, but many of us have been in a situation where we saw our parents fight, and we felt compelled to take sides, perhaps.
So there's a number of calls on the line. Let me read some comments. Adam, a couple of people responding to what you were talking about earlier, music and adolescence and stuff. David from West Hempstead writes, I'm in my early 20s and I hate the bulk of what my generation considers popular. So I'm not sure that I buy that suggestion that embracing pop is the hallmark of adolescence. And similarly, in Quizzigal from Brooklyn, your guest's comment about his teenage son's love of the Strokes as part of his generation is way off. I'm 42 and like the Strokes.
Well, I'd say to your first caller, I wish he had been an adolescent in 1969 to 1974, and he would have a different thing.
When the best music was being made of all time.
Right. And the other thing is, of course, we all can love, I love, you know, Fountains of Wayne and Death Cab for Cutie and things that are not generational at all, but I do think that we get our generational identity from the music we love.
Let's take some calls. Aiden's on the line with us from Brooklyn. Aiden, I understand you're a music teacher. Is that right?
Yeah, I teach. I teach classes from 6 months old to about 4 or 5 years old.
Wow. All right. So you really are getting them young.
Yeah. And it's funny. It seems to be often with the songs that repeat in class. Like for example, this semester we're teaching the Four Seasons, Vivaldi's Four Seasons. So we just play those songs a lot, and there are some kids who will be totally happy through class, and I'll play some slow movement from, I don't know, spring movement or something, and they'll just start crying at the end, and it happens every single time. Or there'll be other kids who will be fine, and then after a while we'll sing some song like This Little Light of Mine or something, and they will just shake, convulse with happiness.
The kids who are crying, are they crying with happiness or are they crying because you're making them miserable?
I hope the former, but I think they, what the moms have told me a few times is that there's certain times that they listen to music and they cry. And I don't know if they're miserable. They'll just kind of sit down and just start crying. Like, they're not yelling, you know?
Yeah.
It's like the song makes them sad.
What does that sound like to you, Dan?
In my laboratory, we've done some work with individuals with Williams syndrome, a genetic disorder. And we've run into kids. They have developmental delay and low IQ, but we've seen 8- and 10-year-olds who will say to us in the lab, play that Mozart piece again after they had just been sobbing while we played it. Play it again because it hurts so good.
And they're not being ironic.
No.
That's the best they can describe the feeling.
The beauty, there's some sadness there, but the beauty overtakes it. I was listening to an advance of the new Paul Simon album, which will be out in April. It's called So Beautiful, So What? And I have to tell you, just the overall sounds, even before you start penetrating the lyrics, were so heartbreakingly gorgeous that I found myself wanting to cry because I had never heard a guitar so beautiful.
Ted is on the line with us from Brooklyn. Ted, you going to make us cry?
Well, it's funny because, I'm a big Melvins fan, Slayer fan. I'm into sort of the heavier stuff for sure. And I was in Bentonville, Arkansas, hometown of Walmart, in a rental car, and I turned the radio on and Carrie Underwood, like Jesus Behind the Wheel or something like that came on, and there was something, maybe I was tired, I don't know, but it was the purity of her voice. I don't even like her as a singer, but something about the purity of her voice made me basically tear up and almost cry, and I was by myself, thank God. But that was a pretty moving experience. So there's got to be something that you're, you know, if you're not ready for it, maybe like you're off guard.
The, you know, lovely line of Noah Coward's, how potent cheap music is. And we all have had that experience. I had it last night. My daughter, my 11-year-old, was playing a Hannah Montana record. And it was really very beautiful. And suddenly I said, what was that, darling? She said, what's Hannah Montana? And you say, oh, well, yeah, you know. And that's an experience we've all had. I guess, Dan, you know, the question I'll press you tonight and I'd press you here is, do you think that when you listen to Mozart, as you were saying, right, the most beautiful thing I know in the world is that last slow movement, Mozart's piano concertos, what is it, the B-flat one? And it has all the beauty you've ever known in life, all the heartbreak you've ever felt in life, all the sadness and all of that. Can science lead us into that music? Can it tell us something that we wouldn't know through our own, just through our own naive experience?
In principle, yes. Now, the thing, and we can talk about it in a moment, that I'd like to put out the caveat that I don't think we know why it is that, David Solcher may know, but I don't know why it is that beauty causes us to be sad. But it can. Pure beauty, innocence, these things coming together can make you really, really cry. And I don't think neuroscience knows why that is. But I do think we can talk a lot about why we have the musical experiences we do. I think we have a lot to say about that. And it's not a simple answer, but it might boil down to one easy idea that we came to before, and that's the tension between familiarity and novelty. And if you get that sweet spot just right, your brain goes crazy because it loves learning, but it loves being able to have an anchor in what it already learned. And when you get it just right, our ancestors must have thrived on being able to find new routes to the watering hole, or to suddenly discover a new fruit that was edible, especially during a drought. And that burst of pleasure you get from some new discovery is what's driving
that's
all
beautiful.
Of it.
New roots to the water. You could write a whole book with that title. That's what every great melody does.
Well,
it shows
yes.
you a new route to the water.
Or every great essay.
And also, you know, the question of why does listening to a sad song when you're sad actually make you feel better? I mean, there are so many ways you can take the conversation.
Well, now, we've talked about that, John, and I think the straightforward answer there is that when you're sad, you usually, not always, feel cut off from other people and misunderstood. The right sad song comes in and you realize, I'm not alone. This person went through that. They feel like I did. I'm not alone at the edge of the cliff anymore.
There's much more where all this conversation came from at the 92nd Street Y tonight. Daniel Levitin and Adam Gopnik with the talk called Music and the Mind from Neurons to Nirvana. 8 p.m. at the 92nd Street Y. Dan and Adam, thank you guys for being with us. It's been
just
a lot of
pleasure.
Fun. This is Soundcheck. A little bit of music here from Daniel Levitin. In a moment, we'll hear about a most unusual ensemble made up entirely of elephants. And later, the reviews for the Spider-Man musical are coming in, and they're coming in early, breaking with tradition. We'll find out why later in the show.